Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Wednesday, June 24th, 2026. Professor Glenn Deason will be here in just a moment. Are the Europeans preparing for war with Russia? Does Russia think they are? Professor Deason, welcome here, my dear friend. Thank you for accommodating our schedule. Russian President Putin yesterday warned newly minted Russian officers that the West is preparing for war with Russia. What is the basis for this warning? Do you know?
Well, I think it's based on a regular threat assessment, if you would look at the intentions and the capabilities. In terms of the intentions, I think from back since 2014, the objective was kind of clear. The goal was to use Ukrainians to weaken Russia. Obviously, that only worked to a certain extent. But now, of course, when Ukraine is losing, there's no good off-ramp. So I think, yeah, this is likely correct. And you hear this from the statement of the Europeans, that is, the European leaders, I would say. That is, they are setting essentially dates for war with Russia. You can argue that this is in, you know, planned defensive war, but given that they don't actually explain why this would be, why Russia would attack, I mean, at the same time, they are increasing their attacks on Russia, which is becoming more direct every day. And you see it in terms of the capabilities they're building. They are, the Germans especially, are now talking about becoming the largest military power in Europe. The defense minister just said that not only volunteers from Germany will have to get ready, but so they're suggesting they would have to actually introduce conscription at some point. And we saw Finland just a week ago remove its restraints on nuclear weapons being transported to its territory or even stored. So the Europeans are, in my opinion, yes, they're preparing for war with Russia. I think it's something they would like to avoid, but it appears that beating Russia with the use of Ukrainians is the only alternative. If this fails, then the next step would be, hopefully, in their eyes, Russia would be weakened, and then they will go to war with Russia. And again, I don't think this is hyperbolic. If you look at the attacks on Moscow recently, this was a huge attack. This could not have been done. And I think no serious analyst says that this could be done without the contribution of the NATO states. And only, was it yesterday or 2 days ago? You had the attacks on the Voronezh region of Russia with the British Storm Shadows, which again can't be fired and target locked in without British involvement. So Europe is already at war with Russia. They're already attacking. The only question is, when does Russia retaliate? And I guess this is the kind of defense the Europeans are planning to retaliate against. That is when Russia finally does retaliate.
You know, you mentioned the storm shadow. This is odd, because at least to me it's odd. Maybe you have an explanation. The day before he resigned from office, or announced this resignation, I suppose he's not gone yet, British Prime Minister Starmer revealed this. Britain, I'm reading the headline from the Telegraph, Britain tests long-range missiles to help Ukraine bomb Moscow. Experimental systems, each carrying a 250-kilogram warhead, could potentially reach Russian capital from Kyiv. Now, I'm not a mathematician, but I assume that this is a very powerful warhead and a very powerful weapon. And he announced this right before he left office. These people, I guess, are serious in wanting to taunt and poke the Russian bear.
Well, I think it's gone way beyond taunting. I think it's quite evident that NATO has already gone to war with Russia. I mean, again, the news article you're posting there, it's, you know, helping, building long-range missiles to help Ukraine bomb Moscow. Keep in mind that we already know that it's NATO war planners who are planning this war. We know that it's Western intelligence agencies which are helping to pick the targets. We know that it's Western satellites guiding these long-range missiles. This is even contractors, which are used from Western countries to launch these missiles. This any help or proxy war is, you know, it's been passed long ago. We are now in a direct war with Russia. And the problem is we create a very strange incentive system for the Russians. That is, what we're doing now is it's building up the European industrial capacity, these missiles which the British are now advertising very openly, to hit Russia. And also industrial zones within Russia where the Russians make weapons. So this is the Europeans allowing themselves to strike anywhere in Russia with heavier and heavier weapons and by simply pretending that it's Ukraine. Meanwhile, the industrial bases across Europe, they are somehow a safe zone. That is, Russia can't retaliate against them. And again, this is an untenable situation for the Russians, because if it was, you know, small scale, it would be one thing. But the Europeans have signaled very clearly they intend to escalate in a huge way. And the only thing they're assuming essentially will happen will be that the Russians will simply have to accept being bombed by the Europeans and the Americans, and there's nothing they can do about it. And if they try to do something and retaliate, well, that's the war the Europeans are preparing for. So
what is the root, the cause of this bellicosity toward Russia?
Well, it's I think it's always been like this. The Russians have always been the very convenient other of the Europeans. I mean, if you go back 200 years, you would have had leading British thinkers from John Stuart Mill and others who were essentially warning against the irrationality of the Russophobia. And this has always been a key problem. And the literature on this is quite thick as well. Now, again, I'd like to be careful in how I phrase myself, but I would argue now Europe has become a cesspool of hatred towards Russia. The rationality is definitely left behind. The argument, if anyone would suggest that, well, perhaps we should be a bit cautious to not trigger a nuclear war, it's, well, the Russians, they started it, they deserve it, or look what they have done. I mean, all rationality is gone. It's just pure hatred now. And again, no rational assessment. Usually, security, you would try to balance off your deterrence with some reassurance. Now it's just not just deterrence, but increasing the attacks on Russia and hoping that they wouldn't dare to retaliate because of, you know, NATO. And of course, while this is happening all at the same time as the U.S. Signals that it would like to draw down its forces in Europe, not entirely, but to a larger extent, then, you know, this is a recipe for war. And that's where we're heading very quickly.
One of the things that President Putin complained about in this talk that he gave, much of which was off the cuff, by the way, he walked down from the podium and actually stood in the middle of all these young men, newly commissioned, I don't know what the title is in Russian, but the equivalent in American and European military of second lieutenant, and he engaged with them, that the Ukrainian infrastructure attacks are a deliberate attempt to destabilize Russia. So one, is there a basis for that? And two, if he believes that, why isn't he responding with tremendous force?
Well, this is the main question. Either he's pushing back because against the hardliners, because the people are arguing that this has gone long enough. We have to begin to restore our deterrent, but with powerful force. You know, more and more pressure is mounting on the Kremlin to do something. Now, why this hasn't been done? I mean, you can have two possible explanations. One is the assumption that things are going very well on the battlefield, and it's not a good time to widen the war to include some European states. The alternative would be that the Russians are preparing for this. That is, they know that a war with Europe is coming. The Europeans are preparing. They're building the weapons. They're talking about it. And essentially, stockpile of the Oreshniks and other weapons are being now prepared en masse to retaliate. Again, that's a possibility, but what I know for sure is that it can't continue down like this. The idea that the Europeans are supposed to produce thousands of very powerful long-range missiles just to destroy everything they find within Russia. I mean, this is the goal of NATO, not just the Europeans. I would argue the U.S. also begins to fall very much in this line. That is, the goal of this war is to weaken Russia. And we knew this already back from 2022. They were very, very clear about this in the first few weeks, that the goal is to weaken Russia and, essentially knock it out of the ranks of great powers.
What is the prospect for a conclusion to the special military operation? I'm intentionally not putting an adjective in front of conclusion. I'm not saying diplomatic. I'm not saying military, because I don't want to box you in. But what is the prospect for this thing ending some way, somehow?
Well, I don't see a clear diplomatic path. The Europeans, they essentially set these five conditions for having talks with Russia, which, well, essentially is a capitulation on the Russian side, which isn't happening. The United States appears to, well, not engage much anymore, if anything. I think they seem increasingly happy that the Europeans are, well, that they successfully outsourced much of this war to the Europeans. And I think there might be something happening once there's a crack in Ukraine, once the front lines collapse completely and you have bigger cities like Sumy, Kharkov, or Zaporizhia beginning to fall, or the entirety of Donbass falling under Russian control. Well, once you have a situation where the military in Ukraine has crashed, or the economy has crashed, or the political system begins to implode, then I think the Europeans would be maybe less enthusiastic about a war, because at the moment they're hoping that the Ukrainians will continue to do the dying and they will be able to essentially support from the rear. And I think this becomes less of a reasonable prospect once Ukraine crashes and collapses. But until that happens, the Europeans will look at any setback in Ukraine as a reason to escalate further. And
The Russians are looking to capture territory which they believe has been historically Russian. We understand that. We get it. And I know you're a political theorist and not a military person. However, from your observations, can you capture and control territory by drones, or do you need troops on the ground?
No, you need troops. Drones play a huge role, of course. They essentially displaced the need for armored vehicles. So, you need huge amount of troops as well. And this is also an area where Russia has an advantage. That is, it has a much larger army. And also, this is the main weakness of the Ukrainians. They have a huge manpower problem, and there's no good way to fill this. I mean, the Europeans are not talking about doing mass deportation of Ukrainians to send them back to Ukraine so they can go and die for NATO. But again, this is if they already fled the country, you know, these are not going to be very motivated soldiers. Right. So, you do need a lot of troops, and the front line appears to be widening. Zelensky has threatened that he will attack Belarus. That would widen the front lines even more, but it also opens up more possibility for pulling NATO into this war. So, overall, the manpower is one of the biggest problems at the moment for the Ukrainians.
Right.
If I can add one thing, that is, if you look at the exchange of bodies, whenever the Russians and Ukrainians exchange dead soldiers, you have crazy numbers. Like, the Russians hand over 1,000 dead Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians hand over like 30, 40 Russians. So this kill ratio is quite extreme. Of course, one can say that, you know, it's because Russia is advancing at the front lines that they are the one collecting bodies. But nonetheless, the casualty ratio is definitely not in the Ukrainian favor. And as the manpower problem gets worse and worse, you have less skilled, less reliable troops on the front line. The losses only intensify.
Our friend and colleague, Colonel McGregor, has referred to German Chancellor Merz as the most dangerous European leader since Hitler. That's quite a comparison. Is there a basis for that? I'm not asking you to criticize Colonel, unless you profoundly disagree. What is MERS doing to militarize a country that is as deeply in debt as Germany is?
Well, I don't think that's an overstatement. I mean, he's the most dangerous leader because Germany has taken a very leading role in trying to mobilize the European continent for a war with Russia. And this war would very quickly, I think, develop into a nuclear confrontation. So that would make it, that would make him the possibly the most dangerous German leader in history. I think this is the big flaw in the thinking of the Europeans, though. That is the assumption of escalation control. That is, if Russia retaliates, then the Europeans will perhaps do many long-range strikes into Moscow. And they essentially watched the Russians over the past 4.5 years, and they assume a complete escalation control, that the Russians will be cautious. You will go gradually up that escalation ladder. If something unexpected happened, then they can de-escalate. This isn't going to be the case. Once Russia strikes Europe and the Europeans then retaliates against Russia, then all bets are off. There's going to be no escalation control then. This is going to spiral out of control very, very fast. So the idea that they can control this, I mean, this is fantasy. These are the things we should discuss, by the way, within NATO, but nobody are. They're just speaking in these emotional cliches. Anyone arguing for caution, well, this is a Russian talking point, and they would quickly be dismissed. I mean, it's, you can see the Europeans sleepwalking into a major war here. This is, a disaster.
So Merz, who has an approval rating where Starmer's is and Macron's is, which is about 18%, is actually converting commercial manufacturing into defense industry manufacturing?
Yeah, well, they can't. If they can't build cars, then they should build weapons. This is the idea. That is this military Keynesianism. We can modernize our industries by just building a lot of weapons. You know, the Germans tried this once before. It didn't end very well, and it looks like they're going to have another go at it. So, it's a disaster, but this is also why I guess the Russophobia and this eagerness for war with Russia, it has other sources to it as well. That is, there's no good economic model in Europe anymore. They don't have the same technological sovereignty as you see among other large powers. They don't have enough industries. They don't have a autonomous digital ecosystem. And the economic model is essentially gone. So the thought now is through military power that this can be something to develop technologies, to build an economy through this military Keynesianism. It's also something that would keep the United States pulled into Europe, so it would maintain the structures of the political West, which we had since World War II. So you have all these other reasons for why it's very convenient to make Russia into the boogeyman. The problem is Russia is not Afghanistan, it's not Iraq, it's not Syria or Libya. This war is going to come to Europe as well. I mean, the European leaders are focused so hard on bringing the war to Russia that they don't think twice about how this is untenable for the Russians, that somehow all of Europe and their industrial zones should be a safe zone, which Russia can't retaliate against. It won't work. And the more the Europeans bring pain to Russia, the more acceptable this format is. So it's, sorry, that was a long answer to why.
No. It was a great answer. I'd like to pick your brain before we leave on the other topic that everybody's talking about, and that is your view of the Iran-United States Memorandum of Understanding. Can this thing last, or will the Israelis sabotage it by attacking Lebanon and not leaving?
I think it's too soon to say. I mean, my first thought was, much like after the 10-point plan, which was supposed to lay the foundation for a ceasefire, the White House began to walk everything back immediately. That is, it wanted an end to the fighting, but he didn't want to abide by any of the commitments. Well, this time around, the Iranians won't stand for it. But we already seen Trump make a lot of comments. He says, you know, the Iranians won't get 10 cents. Well, in the memorandum of understanding, it refers to $300 billion to rebuild Iran. They, you know, with Lebanon, the memorandum says that, you know, Lebanon's sovereignty has to be respected, so Israel can't be there anymore. And Trump started to blame the Hezbollah for the problems in Lebanon. They made comments about the IAEA having the right to do inspections. They made comment that Iran would spend any money it gets for buying American agriculture issues, so agriculture products. So I'm not sure what this is. I mean, on one hand, it could be the White House or the U.S. trying to water down the deal and slowly walk away from it. Or it could simply be noise from the Trump administration, because this is a very unpopular deal. And so he has to sell it to his own public as a victory. But again, go through the text. This is a defeat. And that's what we've been talking on your show for months and months now, that the U.S. was destined to lose this war. And when it would lose, it would have to sign such a humiliating deal. But again, Trump, he doesn't lose. Everything has to be spun as a victory. So maybe this is what he has to do. But I'm skeptical, though, that this can be that this will last. But again, I'm not certain yet. I think it's too early to say.
Professor Deason, thank you very much. I know you're traveling, and I deeply appreciate the time you're taking to chat with us. All the best, my friend. Safe travels, and we'll hope to see you next week.
Thank you, Josh.